Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
We take for granted in America that reporters can do their jobs unmolested, sometimes frustrated by official stonewalling, but never in fear of their lives. That's not true of people who cover the drug wars in Mexico, where week after week we have cases of journalists who disappear, journalists who are killed for exposing corruption, for exposing the nefarious schemes of these drug cartels. Alfredo Corchado has been a longtime correspondent for the Dallas Morning News in Mexico, writing about this. He's the author of a searing book called Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness, a book that charts his extraordinary story. Alfredo Corchado was a fellow this spring at the Institute of Politics, and he and I sat down to talk about his life, where Mexico is today, and the perils of covering one of the most dangerous stories on the planet. Alfredo Corchado, first of all, let me say thank you for being here and for being at the Institute of Politics. You've really enriched the experience of students here by sharing your own, and we're grateful for that.
That was a two-way street, David. Thank you for the opportunity.
Talk to me about your life in two worlds. In Mexico and in the United States, and how you've navigated those worlds.
I left Mexico at the age of six, kicking and screaming. I didn't want to leave.
Talk to me about why not, and what was your life
my,
there?
We had a pretty good life. I come from a very small town in Durango, northern part of Mexico, where I think most of the people there depend on remittances from people working in the United States, and we were among the lucky ones. We had a small little grocery store. We weren't rich by any means, but we had our own grocery store. I would test out the toys that we were going to sell before. Always had plenty of food. My uncles had cornfields, so it was a pretty sweet life.
Though your father spent a fair amount of time in the States, right, working fields.
Yeah, during World War II, there was a program called the Braceros, guest workers, where the U.S. awarded more than 5 million contracts to Mexican workers to come and help with the shortage of people. Many had
agricultural work.
Agricultural work and railroads and other things. I mean, there were people working in Pittsburgh, Ohio, Chicago, obviously the Southwest, and California, but it was helping hands, braceros. That's kind of the rough translation. And many of the fathers in my town were living in the United States. Among them, my father. He came as a 17-year-old. He used to take care of cattle in Mexico. But he hears all these stories of his own family members. He's the youngest of, I think there were nine of them. He's the youngest, and he would hear these stories. I mean, you know, I think the first one in my family who left was my aunt in the 1940s. And, you know, my father would think, if my sister can make it, you know, I will too, and so forth. And so as a bracero, you work for a specific period of time. 9 months in the United States. That was the usual contract, and then you went back home for winter break. I didn't really know my father. I didn't even call him papa, you know, father. He was el señor. And he would come back every Christmas and kind of try to make up for time lost. He would always stop by in El Paso, get some Tony Lama boots and a little hat and say, you know, mijo, and try to kind of, I guess, reconnect during those 2-3 months. I was kind of, you know, wasn't really sad when he left. It was kind of a weird thing. You know, you learn not to get too attached to this stranger. But my father wanted us to be connected, be a family. And his it was kind of interesting if we look at that period, because employers were really concerned that they would lose their workers. I mean, there was such a huge demand for Mexican workers that he said, you know, every time you leave, I'm afraid you're not coming back. So why don't we try to get you a green card? And then my father said, well, yeah, but I have a family back in Mexico. Well, why don't we just bring the whole family with the green card? And that's how we ended up in the United States. Again, it was, I remember crying, you know, the days leading up to that, you know, that I would leave Mexico. I would leave Durango. I mean, unpaved streets, but these streets kind of felt like they belonged to us. I mean, my brothers and I would walk the streets to my grandmother's house to pick up the our food. My mother was a singer in our town. One of the interesting things about working on this book was going back and reporting on my mother. And people would say, you know, when your mother sang, even the roosters stopped to listen. You know, I mean, little details like that kind of gave me a sense of...
You remember your mother singing?
Oh, yes. I remember waking up in the morning and my mother, you know, you just see the back of her and kind of in the showers and splashing water on the plants and singing these old songs that José Alfredo Jiménez, Javier Solís, these songs that, you know, kind of embody Mexico for us.
Your book, by the way, Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness, is a memoir. We'll talk more about it, but when you refer to your book, that's what you're referring to. Great book, by the way, and highly recommended to folks who are listening. Did you resent your dad when you had to move to the States? Did you?
It's interesting. My father would he wasn't a very affectionate man, but I think one of the things he did when I was a young boy, he sent us a postcard. It was the state capital of California. And gave us a sense that our home would look like that. I mean, because everybody said, "Oh, the United States, you're going to go to. I mean, you're going to find a home, you're going to find toilets that flush, and etc." So we were driving up on a bus, Greyhound bus, from El Paso to California, and we stopped at every town. And my brothers would say, "Are we there yet? Are we home yet?" And I would take the car. I said, "No, it doesn't. No, we're not there, but I think we're close." We arrived. He was living in a trailer house with four other farm workers, uncles of ours. We slept outside the trailer house by the melon fields. And I remember everybody in my family remembers this tantrum that I threw, that I got up and I said, "Qué gacho, you know, how terrible of you to have brought us here." But he said something that really struck me then. He said, "We're all going to work hard. We're all going to make it. And if you work hard, life will get better." I didn't know what he meant at the time. But I mean, what choice do I have? You know, I was 6 years old, so you take him at his word. But I think for the longest time, there was a sense of resentment that you took us from Mexico. And you promised me something that just wasn't true.
That's sort of the immigrant's mantra core driving belief that you come to America, you work hard, you can get ahead. It's lost, I think, in the debate today.
It is lost. I as a reporter for the Dallas Morning News, I mean, I'm beginning to go to communities, whether it's here in Chicago, for example, in San Diego, in Dallas, where employers are beginning to ask me, why aren't the Mexicans coming anymore? There's a real sense of what's going to happen next. I think that, I mean, the Mexicans are the boogeyman, they're the punching bags these days, but I think that the day is coming soon where Americans will really miss Mexicans. I mean, you can't really talk about one side or the other without the Mexicans. And I can tell you, I mean, it's, I don't detect outrage on their part whenever I interview immigrants about the current climate. But there is a sense of people being, feeling betrayed, being hurt, people feeling like you continue this path, you're basically sucking away the soul of this country. You know, the whole sense that that this can be a better country. This will be. I'll tell you one anecdote that always kind of resonates with me. And this was 1968, and we're still debating this. I've been living in the United States for 3 years. We're in California, we're in the fields. Bobby Kennedy had just been assassinated.
And I just, let me interject. Your mom was involved with the farm workers, and Cesar Chavez was, you know, famously leading a movement for farm worker rights that Bobby Kennedy embraced as his own.
Right. My mother was very involved, which was kind of controversial because Cesar Chavez in those days did not really welcome undocumented Mexicans, felt that they were driving wages down. My mother was a green card holder, and she would argue with the Chavez people and say, look, we all care about human rights. We need to find Bill O'Bridge. I mean, it was interesting that my mother, a homemaker, very quiet, kind of meek at home, you come to the United States and suddenly she becomes, raising hell left and right with the unions, you know, even leading strikes. Yeah. And I would just watch her and say, well, who is this woman, you know? But when Bobby Kennedy died, we were out in the fields, and they kept broadcasting his famous words, you know, some men see the way things are and ask why. Others dream of things that never were and ask why not. And my mother kind of pulled this all together because they were translating the words into Spanish. And she said, it just kind of made the sign of shh, listen. And we listened to those words, and she said, this is why we came here. This is why we made the sacrifice. And this is what you have to take away from this. And I mean, that was the moment when you knew what the meaning of being an immigrant was, or what you were here for. You know, you had to dream, and you had to believe in that. And that's why not.
It's interesting that you say Chavez was resistant to undocumented workers because he felt that they were driving wages down. I mean, that's part of the debate, that the fear of that in this economic environment, whether it's true or not, is what drives it, in a sense that among people who are hostile, that laws were broken and laws, you know, people should be compliant with laws. Why should some people be compliant with laws and others not? It's and of course, every immigration reform that's been proposed would require undocumented workers to pay back taxes, pay penalties, pay a penalty for breaking the law. But it's a really emotional, visceral kind of issue. And of course, Donald Trump mined it to great advantage.
Right. And I mean, you bring up the issue of undocumented workers and, I guess, illegal immigration. In the mid-60s, when there is there are reforms to the immigration law, there was never really anything to stop the demand for workers. I mean, I remember I think the debate that we're having today about illegal immigration, I mean, goes back to all those years ago when yes, the Bracero program ended. And it was like, it's over now. But yet the demand for workers never stopped. I mean, I talked about Durango earlier. Half my town ended up moving to where we were because people had a need for them, because the demand never really waned. And that those numbers just kept growing and growing and growing to the point that today we're talking about something like 11 million undocumented workers.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've got an incredible story and I want to get back to it, but while we're on this, I know you're working on a second book, and as you mentioned, you've been talking to people. What is a pervasive feeling there? We know that there's been a decline in people coming from Mexico to the U.S. What is the pervasive feeling in the Mexican community in America right now? You said betrayal.
Sense of betrayal. I think immediately after the election, November the 8th, heard a lot of stories about people planning to go back. There was almost a sense of maybe Trump's scenario that there would be mass deportation or self-deportations would come true. I mean, I went back to Mexico and saw a lot of people that were trying to hurry up to finish building those houses. I mean, we in Mexico, you call these houses houses of nostalgia. You know, the immigrant worker who lives in the U.S. and sends money to build the home where someday he will return, and yet that someday never comes. So I think between, I would say, November, January, February, there was a sense of people going back, people who felt, I'm not going to put my kid through this. You know, my kid was a U.S.-born citizen. I'm not going to take the risk of being deported and then leaving my kid behind. I think now I'm seeing a change also where, yes, there is that very, very strong sense of betrayal, a sense that for the last 30 years or so, the economic integration, I think people felt like we were changing. We you know, you're really becoming true neighbors,
mm-hmm.
in a sense. But people are really taking a second look and saying, wait a minute, this is really our country. You know, we have children here who are citizens. We have property here. We have homes here. I don't think that that decision to leave would be that easy. And I think, you know, the people are still kind of waiting to see whether some of these promises will materialize, the mass deportations, the building of the wall, etc. So there is, I think, a pause, if you will, to more of a wait-and-see attitude.
What about attitudes in Mexico toward the U.S.?
That's a great question. And that's something Mexico's kind of headed into, not kind of, but they're headed into the election, presidential election,
yes,
in about a year. Mexico historically has been an anti-U.S. Nationalistic country. I think that's one of the reasons why the ruling party was in power for 71 years. You know, they knew when to whip that into a frenzy, into action. With NAFTA in 1994, I mean, I think Mexicans dared to dream that this day could be different. This could be a different relationship. We've seen less nationalism, less anti-American. That's changing. You're beginning to see that in the presidential campaigns, where people are beginning to talk about the anti-U.S. to try to, you know, gain some points, etc. But what's interesting is, there's also a sense of we want to wait and see if these mass deportations do take place. It was interesting to see places like in some of these places in Mexico that have large expatriate communities, where it's the Americans who have taken to the streets and said, you know, we are also anti-Donald Trump. Don't take this out on us. It's we're with you. And I think that has helped contain the nationalism fervor for now.
There is, you know, there's been quite a bit of speculation that the left could actually win this election, that Obrador, who has run twice before and failed, could actually win. Former mayor of Mexico City, quite left, anti-American, and that Trump could turbocharge that. How realistic is that scenario?
It's pretty realistic. I think it's his race to lose at this point. Although it's also interesting how he has changed his rhetoric to some degree. He is now much more of a conciliator towards the business community.
Trying to make himself a plausible
exactly,
leader.
Exactly, even to the point where he's not blatantly anti-NAFTA, something that he was in the past. And I would say, you know, NAFTA has to be fixed, and we have to do certain things to try to make it better for the working class. But you're right. I mean, he lost twice. There's a lot of attention at state elections that would happen in a couple of weeks. I think if his party wins, he is definitely the guy who people will be watching. But we're still a year away. And the other candidate, one of them is the former president Calderon's wife, who is also a strong candidate, and she's more the conservative base. But I think a lot will depend on what happens in the next few months with the wall, the NAFTA negotiations, and again this whole mass deportation.
The current president Peña Nieto is deeply unpopular by any standards, and that unpopularity was there before Donald Trump visited. But that visit during the campaign, which got a lot of attention here, was disastrous for him.
It's disastrous, and it's reflected in the poll numbers. I mean, he at one point he went down to 12%. I think the numbers the last couple of days, his disapproval rating is something close to 80% in the country. He had an opportunity. I mean, I think at the time when he invited Donald Trump to Mexico, the feeling was he is really taking a risk. But maybe he's going to take Trump to Los Pinos, the presidential palace, and just scold him or say something to defend the rights of Mexicans in front of a world audience. None of that happened. It became a Twitter war where Peña Nieto said, "Yes, I did tell him that in private."
But they stood side by side, and he didn't take that opportunity to publicly upbraid Trump, which from a political standpoint was almost required for him. Why didn't he do that?
People say that he was intimidated by Trump. That somehow Trump, when he got to Los Pinos, he just, as many Mexican colonists will say, he wimped out. He didn't do his job, and it was incredibly embarrassing for the population, not just the Mexicans there, but also Mexicans in the United States. And you start seeing his numbers just dip. They did go up a little more after he said no to the White House and visiting the White House in January.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with Alfredo Corchado. Let's return to your story. You wrote about a visit from a PBS crew when you were a kid to the San Joaquin Valley to chart the experience of farm workers there, and how important that was to you and to others to see that there were people who cared about what was going on. I was wondering when I read that whether that was one of the things that planted somewhere in your head the idea that being a journalist had real power and meaning.
Definitely. I mean, that really did changed my life in many ways. At the time, California had a rule that you had to be 15 to be out in the fields. And I was 13. My mother would put on a big hat and large clothes to try to make me look older.
Because you needed the money.
She needed the money, and it was also summertime, and that's how we bought our supplies for the school and our new clothes for the fall. We worked the summers with my parents. But again, because my mother was a member of the Cesar Chavez, they were always very careful not to break any of Cesar Chavez's rules at the time. But so I'm out in the fields. These guys, reporters, are looking for a story on the conditions of farm workers. What's it like being a kid working in the fields? What's it like not having a toilet, not having clean drinking water, not having a break to eat, et cetera? And I think reporters are smart. You know, I at least their perception, and they looked at me and said, "This kid is not 15." And they came up to me and started asking me questions. I think one of the first questions they asked me was, "You're not 15, are you?" And I said, "No, I'm 13." Something like that. My mother was working beside me. They did the interview. They left, and my mother was just horrified. Even though we had green cards, she thought, "You lied. We lied. We're gonna get deported." Cesar Chavez is going to get so mad that he's going to run us out of the union. But for me, it was this incredible experience that someone actually cared enough to ask me what I thought about this or that. I mean, someone wanted to give me a voice. And that's something I carry on. I dropped out in high school, and my dream at the time was to go back to the fields. Most of the Mexican-American kids were dropping out of school or graduating. They were not going to Berkeley. They weren't going to UCLA, Stanford. They were ending up back in the fields. And I thought, well, what's the point? Why don't I just stay in the fields? And maybe by the time they drop out, I will be their supervisor. I will be the rancher or something, or the labor contractor or something. But my mother persisted. I'm the oldest of nine, and felt that I needed to set the example for the rest of my siblings. Finally bribed me with the car and said, you know, I told my mom, we're sitting.
That's dirty pool, man. A car.
We're sitting in Fresno, California, and I told my mom, I said, "I'm not going back to school." And she says, "Why not?" I said, "You see that car over there? We're in front of a car lot." I said, "That's my dream. I want that car." And right away, she thought, "Here's the deal. You promised me three things. A, you will leave California." Because most Mexican Americans that we saw in the Central Valley, San Joaquin Valley, were working in the fields. Moved to El Paso, where we saw some Mexican Americans wearing ties. And she thought that, you know, we needed role models. B, promised to get an education. And C, promise me you won't get married until you get an education and you will get that car. We'll give you the down payment. We'll give you the first few payments, and then you're on your own. And for a week, I went back and forth.
You mulled over. You mulled the deal over.
It was a very painful decision. Yeah. But it was love or car, love or car. I was dating the rancher's daughter at the time. And I kept thinking love or car, and I picked the car. Ended up in El Paso, went to community college.
You didn't go to the rancher's daughter and say, "If I get that car, would you come to El Paso with me?"
I did. I actually did. And I said, that, you know, my mother's doing this for us. She believes I need an education. I mean, maybe you should come with me to El Paso, or I'll come back to California with the degree. She didn't buy that.
No.
So I went to El Paso, and I went to El Paso Community College to try to get my GED and try to get my foot in the door. And one of the first things that the counselor asked me was, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "What's your study plan?" I had no idea, and I said, I think I want to be a hairdresser." And he looked at me and said, that's all you got?" And he said, "Your parents made this big sacrifice for you?" And I said, "Have you seen the movie Shampoo?" Warren Beatty, et cetera. And he just said, "Why don't we do an aptitude test? And maybe you know, maybe we'll find out something more about you. And they came back and he says, you know, you're curious about the world. You're curious about events. You're curious about this or that. Maybe you should think about being a diplomat or maybe a foreign correspondent. And I said, what is that? He says, they will base you anywhere in the world. And I said, including Mexico. He goes, yes. And that just, it kind of came together.
Well, that's incredible because, you know, to think that a counselor at the El Paso Community College changed your life in that way, it really speaks to the power of education and the importance of the people who spend their lives in education. So that's the course you took.
That's the course I took. I ended up working at the El Paso Community College newspaper, student newspaper, more to get credit. But also you had this big movement on the Mexican side of the border. I mean, I'm living in El Paso, and Ciudad Juarez has become the laboratory for change, for political change. So you can imagine yourself as a reporter covering student issues, and then in the afternoon, evenings, you're covering these massive demonstrations. And I always tell people, I mean, that's when you're lured in by journalism, and you become addicted to journalism. And you realize many years later that there's no cure for it. You know, that's really how it all began.
And professionally, how did your career evolve?
I had a first internship at the El Paso Herald Post, an afternoon paper that doesn't exist anymore. I did a small internship at the Ogden Standard Examiner in Ogden, Utah. But the real break really began with a man named Frank Allen. Frank Allen was the bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal in Philadelphia. And he, I met him at a National Association of Hispanic Journalists convention. This is back in the late 80s, and I think newspapers were feeling that they had to become much more diverse. And Frank really believed in that, in diversity. And he would go to all these conventions, he would scout people and so forth. And he looked at me, I mean, a kid with, you know, jeans and bold shoes, and I'm carrying my family's photo albums with all my clips in the middle, and he came up and talked to me. And he said, I don't think you're ready yet for the Wall Street Journal, but I'd like to keep in touch with you, and I'd like to see your clips and so forth. But the message from Frank was very simple. America's changing, and we need people like you to tell these stories. And there was a real conflict inside of me because it's like, do I become a coda, or do you really like me for my promise? So I ended up going to Philadelphia 2 years later, working in the bureau and covering Black and Decker, covering Campbell's Soup. Nothing had to do with Mexico, but it was very important that I think Frank took me through really the beginnings and taught me the fundamentals of being a journalist.
Yeah, you know, it's, I mean, I speak now as a former journalist, but it's one of these things where you can go to journalism school, but it's really something you learn by doing. And the people who often teach you are your editors, your colleagues. And so that's it's important to have those kind of formative experiences.
He's those years, I think, you look back and you realize that was the key. You know, because it also, I think, it took me away from the border. It took me away from Mexico. And to live in a place like Philadelphia, I formed lifelong friendships. But also, it really taught you as to, do you really want to do this? Is mm-hmm. this what you want to do?
Mm-hmm. And you ended up going to work at the Dallas Morning News.
Left Philadelphia, ended up going to Dallas, the Dallas Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. But again, my dream was to go to Mexico. And the Dallas Morning News, 1994, ended up becoming their correspondent. This was, I think, an exciting time of journalism. I mean, we ended up having the largest bureau of any American newspaper there. Had 12 people, including a TV crew. We were covering all angles of Mexico. We had bureaus in Monterrey. We had bureaus in Colombia. even Havana. We were the, other than the Chicago Tribune, there was the Dallas Morning and the Chicago Tribune with bureaus in Havana. These were the great days of journalism. And I was covering, I was more involved as covering immigration issues, the democratic process in Mexico, and U.S. policy to Latin America. Those were the things I was doing at the time.
What is the complement of American journalists in Mexico now as compared to then?
It's a totally different world. I mean, we're looking at Dallas Morning News went from a 12-person staff to zero today. I'm planning to go back this summer and cover Mexico, cover the border. But it's really the only the major papers that have small bureaus, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times. I mean, back in the day, I think there were four or five major Texas papers, papers from Arizona, the Southwest. And that has really, I think, impacted the way Americans understand Mexico today or do not understand Mexico today. I mean, there's just not that much news that that reaches them.
Yeah, you your book is the subtitle is A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. Talk about that and what you mean by that.
I think at one point every reporter in Mexico or every correspondent in Mexico became a crime reporter because of the drug war. And I went there with, first of all, I promised my parents when I left, they were very much against me going back to Mexico. They thought, you know, we made so much of a sacrifice. We don't want you to go back. And they knew I was determined, but they said, you know, promise us that you will never cover drug traffickers because they don't understand the word forgiveness. My parents had a small little restaurant on South El Paso Street, 2-3 blocks from the border. One of our favorite clients, we later learned, was a member of the drug traffickers who was trying to launder money through our restaurant by offering to give us $100,000 to build other small little restaurants. And we thought, you know, we're coming from California. We didn't really understand that dynamic.
Yeah, we should point out your family ultimately moved to El Paso with you.
Right. So. We moved from California to El Paso. But when we found out that this man had knew our schedules, my siblings, and said, look, if anyone ever finds out, you know, they will pay the price. And we thought, okay, we got to get out of here. So my father blocked the deal, said no to the deal. But he learned that. He said, you know, they don't understand the word forgiveness. Do not cover these stories. And again, we had a large
meaning
enough...
Meaning it's dangerous.
Meaning it's very dangerous. He also felt that, yes, I may be American, because I was now an American citizen, but I'm still very much a Mexican. I wouldn't have the same protection that an American journalist would have. It didn't really faze me because I thought I'm not interested in these stories. I'm more interested in these, and again, you know, in democracy and immigration, etc. But at some point, I think with the decline of staffs, decreasing staffs, and then Mexico. I think when Mexico became the first opposition government comes in the year 2000, a very centralized system becomes decentralized. The power leaves Mexico City, and suddenly the power is going to all these states. And the narcos, who there's a lot of complicity, there's a lot of corruption within the agencies, within the government itself. They become wild boys. I mean, things really get out of hand. And as a reporter, you become a crime reporter. And so it was my job all of a sudden to shift my focus from other issues, from the Vicente Fox, George W. Bush relationship, immigration, to solely looking at why Mexico was really falling apart. And you begin to follow, you know, people talk about follow the money. I mean, we're basically following a trail of bodies throughout the country. and how certain groups have become so emboldened that they were showing videos of beheadings and so forth. And really the what that meant for a young country with a fledgling democracy. And that's why the title.
Yeah.
You fall into the darkness of a country.
And what does it mean for the country? And describe how pervasive these cartels are and their influence over government and law enforcement in Mexico today.
I look back and I think that part of the problem that I had was I was so naive about how these cartels work, how they function. Again, I hadn't really paid that much attention, but soon enough, you're learning that in communities, in very key communities, especially along the U.S.-Mexico border, the mayor's office is infiltrated by cartels. The local police department, the state police, the journalism office or newsrooms are infiltrated. Just about every key organization is infiltrated by cartels. The state police takes, they work for one rival cartel. The local police works for the other rival cartel. And so you have this madness.
And they're infiltrated by money, fear.
By money and fear. And it used to be more money. But I think what happened in the 2000s and in the current phase that we're living, it's really fear. It used to be the bullet or the bribe. Nowadays they don't even make you that kind of offer. It's the bullet. There was a cartel, a paramilitary group that I think changed the whole dynamics in Mexico. A group called the Zetas. Some members were trained by U.S. Special Forces to take on the cartels. They go back. The cartels basically bring him in with money and say, you know, if you're out to get us, but we're going to pay you money to work for us. 35 members deserted the Mexican military and ended up becoming their own separate cartel. But they set a whole new standard in Mexico through fear, through killing a mass number of people, through hanging people on, you know, from bridges, public bridges, beheading them, taking, sending to newspapers, sending to offices, you know, the heads of rivals and so forth, and saying you're next. And obviously, something like 180,000 people were killed during this period, and journalists were also on the firing line.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. Alfredo, you mentioned the killing of journalists and violence generally. I don't think people broadly recognize that Mexico, you know, you get outside of Afghanistan and Iraq, Mexico is the most dangerous place for journalists. And among the most violent places around. How do you function in an environment like that? And what's your own level of fear?
You function very, very, very carefully. It's important you bring up Afghanistan and Syria and other Somalia because mm-hmm. there's no real declared conflict in Mexico. And I think in many ways that makes it even that much more dangerous. Because you don't really know who to trust or where the bullet may be coming from. It's a situation where you don't know who to trust. You know, you don't know who to talk to. I have to make it clear that yes, I was born in Durango. Yes, I'm Mexican. Yes, people may see me, and there's an expression in Mexico, you know, you may see the cactus on my forehead, and that gives me away as a sure Mexican. But as I report in some of these communities, I'm always careful to make sure that my passport is sticking out, the U.S. passport, that the credentials are hanging over me, the congressional, the State Department, my own newspaper. Make it clear to people that I'm an American citizen. When I come into a community, I make it a point to go see the mayor, to make see the police chief and say, I'm here for the Dallas Morning News, and I'm doing this, I'm doing that. Get the message out.
Because you think, because there's a reluctance to kill Americans.
That's what I believe. That's what I believe. I mean, there are people, friends of mine, colleagues of mine, who may disagree with me. But I believe that that cartels are afraid of the consequences. It, I mean, we're talking about a $30, $40 billion industry. You bring too much noise, you bring the attention of the U.S. government, it's not good for business. Having said that, I think the cartels in recent years have changed dramatically. Where when I started covering them, there were maybe four or five major cartels in Mexico. These days, there are more than 100 criminal groups. And I say that because I don't know that the younger generation understands the consequences. I don't know that they're thinking as their elders were at one point.
This is such an interesting point because, you know, I'm thinking about there's a big gang problem in parts of Chicago. And part of what people attribute that to is that some of the older gang leaders have been tried and put in prison. And now you've got younger, less sophisticated gang leaders who are more imprudent than the older guys who thought of themselves as running businesses, whereas these kids are more apt to be trigger happy and employ violence as a tool. So it's a similar kind of situation.
Many parallels.
Yeah, yeah. What is American policy? I'm going to return at the end to this issue of being a journalist in that kind of environment. What about American policies? You say they don't want to bring the wrath of America down on them, these cartels. And it suggests that America isn't doing enough to fight these cartels. Is that your judgment?
I think we've seen the face where during the George W. Bush period, you had the media initiative, which was much more, it was a policy that was much more oriented towards helping Mexico via military help. I think the last few years of the Obama administration, still under the media initiative, the focus was much more on building the society, building communities, building civil societies. And that was something that you began to see a difference in some communities, where people started really learn how to hold the government accountable. Not in the American way. I mean, I think it's still a democracy very much in diapers. But you began to see a real change. And I think that's long-term, that's Mexico's best hope, is that communities really learn to become civil society communities, or, you know, learning to... judicial reform, trusting police or working with police. The sense today, I've talked to people who are close to cartels, is they don't think America really cares that much anymore. They don't on a society level. They the question as to what will the Trump administration do? Will they continue supporting these communities, or is it over? On the cartel side, we can do this, we can do that, and I don't know there'll be any kind of payback on the part of the U.S.
There's an argument that you can't attack this problem from the supply side, just too difficult, that perhaps the way to attack it is from the demand side, and that goes to the issue of legalization. You know, the U.S. is the main recipient of all of these drugs. I think Chicago was El Chapo's number one market.
Right.
And the question is if there were some sort of legalization of at some level of drugs, you know, with money diverted to treatment here, would that have an impact on the cartels in Mexico?
There was a term that we heard a lot about during the Obama administration, which is co-responsibility. I mean, Mexico cannot do this alone. There has to be the demand side has to be addressed. On the Mexican side, I think if there's one thing that gives me hope is a sense that people also kind of looking, taking a look, a deep look at themselves in the mirror. Mexicans are, and saying, wait a minute, there's so much corruption with their own government, and we're part of the problem. But until the United States deals with the demand, no, it doesn't matter what we do. It's such a powerful force. And yet, you know, there's kind of a funny story. Colorado started legalizing. I mean, they legalized Washington. I think some other states are looking.
Yes, marijuana.
Marijuana. And you're beginning to see more of the high-end Mexicans who are buying stuff from the U.S., because they think the U.S. stuff is, there's much more quality. And this is a real affront to some of the Mexican cartels who are also committed to trying to upgrade their quality. So, I mean, it's, the impact goes both ways.
Yeah, doesn't that make you proud as an American? We always produce great stuff
right,
here.
Right, except for tacos.
So on this issue of legalization, do you think that would be a blow to the cartels? I mean, I have mixed feelings about the issue, but I'm just wondering about what impact you think it might have.
I talked to one cartel person a while back, and I said, "What happens if the Americans decide tomorrow to legalize everything?" And he said, "You know, we'll probably go on vacation. We'll mm-hmm. probably go to the beach and enjoy some of our billions for a little while." But I wouldn't put it past them that at some point they're going to say, "You know what? Galletas Marias, Marias cookies, very popular in Mexico, are contributing to American obesity, and we're going to ban them." Says once they do that, we're back at work. Anything that's banned in the U.S., anything that becomes illegal, is business for us, because we operate in a system where the institutions are so weak, where you can basically push things around however you want. So again, you know, it's going back to this whole sense of co-responsibility.
What do you mentioned NAFTA earlier? Just shifting for a second, President Trump has indicated that he wants to reopen negotiations. Apparently, they are going to be reopened. How do you evaluate the impact of that potentially on Mexico and on relations between the two countries? And what do you think is going to come of these negotiations?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that NAFTA was not the panacea that Americans think it was. I mean, the Americans in Ohio, Americans in Michigan, Pennsylvania, who think we were ripped off. I mean, Mexicans today are still earning $5, $6, $7 a day. They're not. If anyone,
I think the guys in Ohio and Michigan and so on would acknowledge that, but their point is that they were working for middle class wages, and now Mexicans are, you know, working for less. But that's why the factories went there,
and both sides are getting just as screwed,
right?
But I think it's important to look at the NAFTA negotiations. I mean, what I'm looking at as a reporter is I think they start in August or sometime this year. That will determine, I think, who the candidate becomes for the for Peña Nieto's successor. That, I think, will determine as to who becomes the next president of Mexico. People will be looking at that very closely.
So if there's a perception that Mexico got the short end of the stick in these negotiations, it may radicalize the electorate more.
You will see Andrés Manuel López Obrador's numbers just climb, and making it very possible that this may be his election, this may be his victory.
I want to return to the dangers of reporting from Mexico. You just lost a very prominent journalist there. He is among one of many who have lost their lives. Talk about him, Javier Valdez Cardenas.
This was staggering. We've lost 106, 107. It's hard to keep up with the numbers, because there was another one who's gone missing this week, presumed dead. So the numbers may climb up to 107. This is 107 people killed since the year 2000. And these are the conservative figures that are provided by the Committee to Protect Journalists. Other agencies have the numbers much higher. Javier Cardenas was I think, a turning point for many Mexican journalists who believed that if you were prominent enough, if you were an award-winning journalist recognized from both sides of the border, that gave you a sense of protection. I remember back in 2010 or so, Committed to Protect Journalists was very committed to try to find key journalists in Mexico to try to bestow recognition, protect them, and so forth. And at the time, many correspondents felt that CPJ recognizing Javier was incredibly important. And we're hoping that this would become the start of a new trend to identify key reporters, get them to the Nieman Fellowship at Harvard or other other places in the United States.
And you're one of the people who, you got a Nieman Fellowship.
I got a Nieman Fellowship in 2009. And since then, I mean, I've been helpful in trying to get two other people at the foundation. But talking to my colleagues the last week, I mean, that sense of protection is gone. And again, there's no real public outcry. There's no public outcry in Mexico among the citizens, among residents. There's no real outcry in the United States. And I would say these are our neighbors. And if people really do care about a democratic Mexico, you can't have a democracy without a press trying to hold you accountable.
Well, this would be unthinkable in the U.S. We take for granted the freedom of the press, even as we struggle at times over it. It is fundamental to a democracy, even if office holders don't always appreciate it, to have a free press. But what about you? You're about to return. Do you do so with heightened fear for yourself?
I woke up on November the 9th, and I thought, I'm going back. I'm going back to journalism. I hadn't really felt that sense of fear until Javier was killed. I think that shattered my own myth that if you have protection, there's a, maybe they'll leave you alone. I still have my place in Mexico City. I still plan to report out of Mexico City. And some reporting, or much of my reporting, also from the U.S.-Mexico border. But I would be lying to you if I told you I don't think about that, and that there's not a part of me that is feels a sense of trepidation. You know, that a lot of these memories have come back. That same debate is back. Is this worth it? Do I go back? Do I even try to tell the story?
And why are you going?
I believe in journalism. I mean, I believe in journalism, but I also believe in my home country. And I think, especially the last year, being away from Mexico, I see my homeland from a different lens. And sometimes I'm someone who belongs to two countries. I mean, I have two homelands. Sometimes I feel that's really why I like the border, because you really don't have to choose anymore. You're there. But sometimes when I go to Mexico, I even feel there's a more hopeful feeling. In spite of all the troubles that we've talked about, there's a sense of hope that sometimes I feel like we're losing in this country. And I want to be able to tell those stories. I don't know that I will take the same chances I took, but I think there's so many other stories that I can also report on.
You know, I note that you never did. You asked the rancher's daughter to come to El Paso with you. You never did actually settle down. You never got married. You never had a family. Is part of it because of the life you live? I mean, is part of that?
Well, I've been lucky that I've had a long time companion who's also a journalist. And like me, also born in Mexico City and from the United States. But I think when we talk about it, we always talk about trying to reconnect with the homeland. And maybe by doing that, you also try to reconnect your readers, your viewers, to both sides. Obviously, I think we've done a lousy job because of the way Mexico is portrayed these days. But I think all it does is that it makes me want to go back and tell these stories and maybe listen a little closer.
Well, Alfredo Corchado, we are so grateful for you to be with us at the Institute of Politics, to be with us today. And I just want to honor your courage in taking the risks you're taking to tell those stories. And in honoring you, I want to honor every journalist all over the planet and in Mexico who take risks every day to tell these stories. We owe you a great debt of gratitude, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you, David. And on behalf of many of my colleagues in Mexico, thank you for your solidarity.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.